Welcome to the AquariumMax audio show with Russ and Kelly. We provide information on all kinds of aquarium-related topics. This is episode 51, recorded February 25th, 2011. There's a lot of reasons we're excited for today's episode. One is that Brian from Idaho won the contest for the live food. So congratulations, Brian, and your microworms will be in the mail in a couple of days. We'd also like to thank Robert from Michigan for sending his voice message, and we will talk about that in depth next week. And perhaps our biggest news of the week is that we have a special guest today. We're going to delve a bit into the marine side of the hobby with this guest who created, as his doctoral dissertation, a captive breeding program for feather duster worms. All right, we are excited to welcome our guest and our friend Dave, who is a marine biologist who currently lives in Hawaii. And we met Dave while we lived there and had some adventures with him. So we're glad to have him here on the show with us today.
Thanks, glad to be here.
All right, let's see, doing a quick technical check. Looks like it's all working. So, all right. Well, we'd like to focus on one thing. There's a lot we could talk about today, I'm sure, but we decided to pick one thing specifically, and that is your experience with feather dusters.
Uh-huh.
Because that was your doctoral thesis, was it not, or your dissertation? I mean.
Yeah, reproduction and life history in one of the species, the larger species.
Okay, so tell us a little bit about that. What, how did you get into that, and what was the rationale for your study?
Well, A, I needed a project, and B, I needed to graduate. those were both good incentives, but so beyond that, there, one of the professors who was on my committee, he was involved in freshwater ornamental aquaculture of fish in some of his other work. So he went to a meeting in Florida, a marine ornamentals meeting, I believe. And I guess he came back and had this idea because there was such a need for marine ornamentals and reproductive information, for, like I said, for marine species, where almost everything's worked out with the freshwater, but the marine species, very few of them have actually been studied to the point where, you know, you can culture them. So one of the major targets, he came back with this idea to target the Sabellastardis spectabilis, the large feather duster we have here in Hawaii. In Kaneohe Bay, there's huge density of these things, and so the concern, of course, is that because there's a market for them and because there are a lot of them, collectors go out after them and they associate or they settle mostly on corals and down the cracks and crevices of corals. So to get them, a lot of times you have to chisel the reef away and break it apart. And so there was concern that over time the reefs were being damaged for collection purposes of these things. And so the idea was, well, let's just culture them, let's grow them. But, you know, it turns out nobody had ever cared to look at any sort of reproductive information. So when I started, there was nothing in the literature. And he said, hey, do you want to do it? And I said, yeah, sure. So that's kind of how we got started.
Cool. So the basic motive back there was to have a way to save the damage to the reefs and still promote the aquaculture industry at the same time.
Yeah, exactly, to provide a more sustainable source and to decrease that destructive collecting.
Cool. One thing I should probably mention, some of our listeners who are predominantly freshwater hobbyists may not be familiar with feather dusters. Can you just give a brief description of what they are?
Yeah, sure. They're a marine polychaete tube worm. So they're a worm that builds this tube, and the radials, or they're also kind of considered gills because they are important for respiration and also for feeding. They look like a flower. comes up out of the tube, and they'll, when they're disturbed, they'll suck down into the tube and then come back out. But they are actually, they look like a flower. They're an animal. They're a marine worm.
Yeah, they're very pretty.
They are indeed.
Thank you for saying that, Kelly. I think so, too.
I miss ours.
They're like flowers. Yeah.
So tell us some of the factors that you found that influenced the breeding of the feather dusters.
Well, that some of the things that I found out after I did my work on these, I'm still doing work and probably will be for the rest of my life, it seems like, on these, because there's, you know, one question or one answer leads to more questions. But some of the main factors that determine normal reproductive cycles in nature, we linked to water temperature. Mm-hmm. And with a peak breeding, at least in nature, and it seemed to be a peak in October. And that was right, also linked, I have a whole bunch of water data for several years, water temperature data. And so as the water temperatures here in Hawaii, at least, start to go down and it gets colder, that's right around when we see a big October spawn. I also, in my lab, have been able to induce them to reproduce in June and July. So my theory is that that you get it as the water temperatures are changing, so that you get maturation in these things. You can watch it, and I've watched the gametes, the eggs and the sperm. I can watch them in my histology slides throughout each month of the year. And they start to mature right around March, when January, February, not a lot's happening because, I mean, we're in Hawaii, but the water temperature is a little colder. In March, it starts to change, and I'll start to see gametes forming inside. And then they'll continue to mature, and like I said, no one that I know of really has ever seen them spawn in nature, but I've been able to induce them in June, July, and then the only other time I've been able to induce them is October and a little bit in November. So my hypothesis is that as water's warm, they start to mature, gets to its, you know, nice hot point in June, July, they spawn, and then they go through another gametogenic cycle where they're maturing. And then just as the waters start to cool, that's another cue, boom, and they spawn then.
Interesting.
So they'll do it sort of a biannual effect.
Well, in my paper, formally what I've reported is October, but unpublished data shows also that I had some success in June and July, but that's not as predictable as the other.
Okay. Now, were the changes in June and July dependent on temperatures that you modified, or just temperatures based on the water that you had available?
Well, my water temperatures are all... I have all this in my head, and so I think it makes sense to everyone, but really it's hiding in my head, and I haven't said it yet. So if I'm talking about something that doesn't seem to make sense, just go ahead and ask. But the temperatures are from... sensors that we had around Coconut Island. So these are water temperatures in nature that I'm comparing it to.
Okay.
In my lab, I've done a little bit of manipulation of water temperature, but I actually developed another technique to get them to spawn, and so I've been using that to try and induce them to spawn. I am, though, going to start looking more and more at water temperature and see if that actually... manipulating the water temperature, I could get them to spawn on that.
Okay. Just based on basically the cues that they seem to be using in nature, then.
Right, so I'll look at... Well, so I'll watch how those gametes grow and mature, and then when... So I'm going out... I used to go out every month and take 25 samples, 25 worms off the reef, and then I would do histology on them. I would know what was happening internally to every single month of the year. And that's how I'd watch the rise and fall of these gametes. So I see a rise and then a fall in June, and then I see a rise and then a fall in October, and then I link that to water temperature and trying to work on a couple other variables. But none of the other variables I looked at seemed to actually correlate statistically.
Oh, okay. So that seems to be the winner there.
Yep.
Cool. All right. Well, we wanted to ask you, too, when you were raising the worms, once you've got them to spawn in the lab and you begin to raise the young, what did you find was very helpful or effective as you raised them in terms of food you used or substrates for them to settle on and so on?
Yeah, that was tricky at first. They have about the larvae themselves have about a 7 to 8 day pelagic period, so they're just swimming around in the water column. They're living completely off of yolk stores, so you don't really need to feed the larvae. And once they settle, they will settle on, like, I got them settling on glass, but most of them would die rather than settle on it. So I put in all these other substrates, and the thing that I found they loved the most was air stones. Got these big white, I think they were, what were they, silicate or something, air stones. And I got coral rubble, and they like to settle on that. Those are the two best ones.
Hmm. Okay. And what kind of density would you get as far as how many would settle on a given square inch or something like that?
Oh, I should have read my paper. I can't remember, but I remember that on the air stones was actually more than on the coral rubble, and we were getting like 300 per centimeter squared or something like that.
Wow.
Yeah, it was. They were literally, you couldn't see the air stone. It was just this big puff ball of feather dusters.
Wow. And were they able to survive in that density through maturity too?
They did. They survived. I guess it depends on. We didn't leave them because that they get so big, and we knew that was going to be a problem. So we wanted to do grow out experiments. So at a certain point, we let them get to a certain stage, and then we kind of had to carefully try and pick them all off, which was difficult. But they survived as long as we left them there.
Cool.
That's pretty amazing.
Yeah, such density would be. I do remember when we went to the facility and you showed us some on the air stone, and they were just packed.
Oh, okay, so you guys did see that.
Yeah, yeah.
New York City of feather duster worms.
Yeah, the good old days.
Let's see.
We have fond memories of that island.
We do, yeah.
Good.
Gwen was born that day.
She was, yep. All that walking around.
Oh, my
goodness.
Did we not tell you that?
Did I forget that? That's great.
Yeah, that's what...
It was all that talking about feather duster induction, spawning induction.
That must have been
reproduction.
See, that leads to another study. You know, you could look into that.
I could market it to hospitals.
There you go. Now, what about food? I seem to remember that you cultured some unicellular algae for them? Is that what turned out to be the best, or?
Yeah, and then actually what we did was later, I did after, I think you guys left, we did a feed study where we compared several different types of algae. Some of the algae was that, what do you call that? You know, you can get that, preserved algae.
Yeah.
So we tested different preserved algae that you can buy and live algae and different strains of algae, and found the best that I've found, one that we used and that was very successful, was Kitoceras. And the other, excuse me, I'm trying to remember the name. I remember it was I think it was Isochrysis.
Oh, okay.
It was a Tahitian strain of Isochrysis that was the best.
Oh, that seems to be a pretty popular one for cryopastes and things like that.
Yeah.
That I've noticed, yeah.
But so we found that the live stuff was the best, but the preserved isochrysis that I think was Reed Mariculture or somebody like that that we bought it from actually was very, very close to being as good as the live isochrysis and better than some of the other live algae that we gave. So,
Wow.
Yeah. I better look those up to make sure that I'm getting them in all right, but that's what my memory tells me.
Okay. Yeah, I remember we used a couple of different things. We used a cryo paste that was, I think, Nanochloropsis.
Oh, we did test nano, yeah.
And then we used another one. I can't remember what it was now, but it was the kind that you keep in the refrigerator, but it wasn't frozen. It was just a refrigerated liquid.
Yeah, that's what we used. That was our preserved stuff.
Okay.
And I said, I think the nano did okay, but I think the ISO was the best.
Best stuff, okay. Okay.
So if someone has one in that tank, in their tank, is that something they can get from aquarium supply places?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know about aquarium supply. I know we got it from Reed Mariculture, which is more of like an aquaculture supply place, but I'm assuming they would sell as well to anybody who orders.
Yeah, and I've been able to find some of those just at aquarium stores. Not like big box stores that sell fish, but aquarium-specific stores will often have a refrigerated area with cryo paste for different algaes, and even some of them have live algae cultures.
Oh, cool.
Which is nice. So we've got one.
You can find that there in Utah?
Yeah, there's a really good local shop here that is just a fish store, basically, and they have all kinds of things like that. They have rotifers and everything in live culture you can get.
Do they have feather esters?
Yeah, sometimes they do.
Hmm. So. Interesting. Do you know if they come from Hawaii?
No, I should ask next time we're down there.
Yeah, that'd be interesting to know.
Yeah.
But we think about you every time we see them.
Yeah.
Good.
Well, it looks like it's time for our break, so we're going to take a little pause here.
Okay.
And then we'll start up again.
This isn't a commercial, because it's not trying to sell you anything. It is, however, the part where we shamelessly encourage you to be a part of the Aquarimax audio show by calling and leaving a message any time of the day or night at 801-477-0629. If you don't want to actually talk, but you do have a comment or question, you can just send us an email to info@aquarimax.com. There. That wasn't so painful now, was it?
Okay, we're back on the air, ladies and gentlemen. I hope you missed us. And here we go. Dave, we're going to ask you another question.
Okay.
Tell us how, or if they have potential breeders responded to your results?
Well, I guess that's kind of an interesting question because the breeders, well, I had a guy in... I guess the short answer is locally or nationally, no. Internationally, kind of yes. So we took it once I got all this kind of worked out and felt comfortable with the fact that we could make this happen, meaning that we could induce and get larvae through to settlement into an adult stage. We took it to a local group here who was doing some work in Hawaiian fish ponds and trying to diversify the use for native Hawaiian fish ponds. I don't know how familiar your listeners will be with those, but basically it's just an area of coastal kind of aquaculture that was used for lots of years by native Hawaiians to raise fish, but now they're trying to find ways to use those in a diversified manner that will be also that will kind of fit a modern society and not just for traditional uses. So one of the things that they were looking at was, okay, what else can we do in there? And we said, hey, what about if you were to raise some ornamental species in there and you could sell those and generate some revenue? So we went out and started talking to them and started doing a few grow out experiments in their pond. It's an 80 acre enclosed marine pond that has tidal flux that comes in and out certain gated areas. And so it seemed like an ideal habitat. And we started doing some of the work out there, but I'm not quite sure what happened. They just, after a few months, said, hey, we're kind of changing gears and we're not really into research and development things anymore. So, I'm not really sure what happened. I think there were some political things going on and they were changing some of their directors and everything. So that never went through. We were basically saying, here, let me give this to you. This could, you know, generate some revenue. Then I had another guy who was interested on the island of Kosrae, and he runs a pretty decent aquaculture facility out there, mostly, I think, for marine ornamental species. I know he does, you know, tridacna clams and stuff. Anyway, I've been communicating back and forth with him, and then we were going to go out there, and I was going to help him learn how to do it because they have a natural population adjacent, you know, out on the reef there where he lives, so he could just get broodstock from there. But complications there in that his government was supposed to provide some of the funding through UH that was going to help get me and someone else to go down there, and the government didn't provide that in the end, and so, you know, we weren't able to get down there. So I guess that's one thing that's been on my mind lately is that, boy, I really had high hopes for this, but it seems like no one has really grabbed onto it yet. So I've been so busy with other things trying to, you know, get established in a job and everything, but I recently have been thinking, hey, maybe I'll just do it in my garage.
Maybe you should. You can be the distributor yourself.
Yeah. So I don't know. At this point, no one is really doing it, no.
Hmm. Okay. Because this is an interesting thing that I've noticed lately in pet stores the last few months. I don't know exactly. Maybe it's been more than that. But I've seen duster clusters marketed.
Yeah. I wonder if... I guess, do you know what species those were?
They looked like Sibelostardis spetabilis.
Well, that would be really interesting because we had actually thought about, you know, when we were working through this similar thing, you know, you can, especially when you see how they settle on those hairstones, you see, oh, it could develop all these little clusters and market them that way, but no one that I know of knows how to do it or is doing it, so it'd be interesting to find out where those come from.
Yeah, I immediately thought of you and your project because I thought, that reminds me of the airstones that you showed me. Yeah. That's the density was comparable.
Well, I wonder if maybe somebody else has gotten into that. That'd be interesting.
Yeah.
Maybe we should do some poking around about where they're getting them and see if we can
do
a little aquatic smoothie.
Yeah, it may be that there's just a private breeder because I think it was at Fish for You where we saw them. And I think I've seen them a couple other places too. But they do a lot with local breeders. You know, some of the fish that I breed, I'll bring in there, and they'll give me credit for, and so on like that. They like to do that a lot. And so there could be someone who just has a small-scale operation going, I guess.
Well, see, now that would be absolutely fascinating for me because, A, I would be really happy that someone were actually doing it, and B, I would be really interested to know how they're doing it. Was it something that, you know, we put in the literature that was helpful, or did they figure something out on their own?
Yeah, I would be interested in finding that.
Remind me next time we're over there. Definitely pass it on.
We need to ask them about that. Now, because I thought a wild feather dusters, it would be really hard to get them all to cluster like that, and especially they were young. They were not very large or mature-looking ones. They looked like they were just, they were still juveniles, definitely. And extremely dense on whatever substrate they had put them on.
You know that, yeah. I mean, you could. No, that would be almost impossible to just do that manually.
Yeah, so, that's what I was thinking. So.
Wow. Yeah, now you've got me wondering. You got to figure that out and let me know.
Yeah, maybe we need to Google duster cluster and see if we find something.
There you go.
Should have done that, but.
Well, we can.
Didn't occur to me.
Ask them at the pet store too.
Yeah, and we'll ask him next time we're in there. I wanted to ask you about longevity of feather dusters. Have you gathered any more data on that, of the captive ones?
You mean longevity in an aquarium?
Yeah.
Well, that's a kind of a hard one for me because my system where I worked on, you saw out there at Coconut Island, was it's flow-through.
Right.
So, and in the flow-through system, they'll do good for a long time, but after a while, even in there, they kind of become less and less happy. And I found out that I think there's some, in some of the water that we pump in and pump out, there was some filtrations on the water coming in that I wasn't aware of. So really they weren't getting all the plankton they would get out in the wild. So after a while, I'd either have to feed them or I would have to, you know, take them in baskets and set them outside for a while and then bring them back. But I have heard and I've seen people that have had them keep them in their aquaria for, you know, years.
Yeah. Yeah, ours lasted 3 years and 3 months.
They've lasted 3 years and 3 months?
Yeah.
Did. Yeah, yeah. For our listeners, we named our feather duster worm after Dave, so.
Yep. And it was our kids who did it.
Yeah.
Well, I'm honored.
Yeah, you definitely take it as a compliment.
I do. Yeah. So years lasted, and then, so was that while you were here that he passed on, or was it in Utah?
No, it was in Utah. He got here successfully and lived quite a while here. Probably about a year and a half or almost that here. So we had him, you know, about 2 years in Hawaii and then almost a year and a half, mm-hmm. or a year and a quarter, whatever it was, here in Utah.
Well, my guess is that they're fairly long-lived for invertebrates. So there's a related family of worms that someone has done. I read a paper on, and because they have a harder tube, they're able to facilitated his study on longevity and these things. I think he'd estimated that they were anywhere from, you know, 10 to 20 years old, some of them 30. So,
wow.
Now, but like I said, it's a different family, but these guys, my guess is that they are long-lived. Out on the reef where I was doing my work, I would find some feather duster sometimes out there that were, you know, the flower part, the radial, the crown was, you know, probably 6-7 inches in diameter, and you could see that the coral had grown up around it, and coral is fairly slow growing.
Wow.
So that would have taken years for that coral formation to have to grow up around the feather duster. So my guess is that they're out there for years.
For several years.
Neat.
Yeah, that is. That's cool.
That's very cool.
And I read an article once that said that in aquaria, they tend to, that some people have greater success, but a lot of people, after 3 to 6 months, they pass on. But I guess that, and I think the article mentioned this, is that it's often because in reef aquaria, they're protein skimming the heck out of all the plankton.
That's going to be my guess, is that they're just not getting the food that they need. I mean, and I've tried, I think in some of our previous feed experiments, we tried some of the stuff they sell in aquarium stores, you know, like general invertebrate food and stuff like that. And
mm-hmm.
at least my experiments didn't show any real great growth on that. In fact, one of them seemed to kill them.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah, I would guess that it's related to that.
Could it be that it clogs their respiratory system or something like that?
Oh, the food?
Yeah, if it kills them directly, is that what it might be doing? Or?
Well, I just think they starved because what they would do is they'll filter it out of the water, so the water will be clear again. But you see it ball up in these mucus balls near the mouth, and then they just shoot it off, and you'll see it flying off the side or out into the water column. They wad it up into mucus balls, and then it just lays down the bottom. They won't. If they don't like it, for some reason, they won't eat it.
They'll collect it, but then they spit it out, so to speak.
Kind of like kids.
Yeah,
I've seen that same behavior recently.
Yeah. I do remember that with ours, if I would stir something up, if I were like digging in the sand or something, I remember seeing him do that. When the detritus would kick up and he would ball it up and shoot it off the little tip of one of the little, in the middle of the radial, that little area with the little point, and he would send it off of there. So what is that little point called in the middle of the radial anyway? I don't think I know that.
You're talking about the radials are the feathery structures, right?
Yeah, and right in the middle of it, in the center of it, there's, like where his mouth is, there's a little point that kind of sticks up. And it looks like...
You're talking about two of them? Or is there two or one?
I'm trying to remember now. I think there may be two.
Okay, generally they'll have two. And, boy, you just got me. I'm trying to remember the name, too. I think they are...
I think the technical name is...
Those are palps. Sorry, those are the palps.
Palps, okay. Palps. Yeah. Yeah, but I remember seeing him do that
pointy
behavior.
Palps.
It was interesting.
Yeah.
And, you remember the video that we sent you, the video clip of Dave opening with the music and everything?
Oh, I loved that. Yeah, I've used that several times.
Yeah? Good.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, I'm actually going to put it up with the resources page. So listeners, you can click on the podcast resources page for this episode, episode 51, and you can see on YouTube our Feather Duster Dave opening in a dramatic and suitably musical fashion. Yeah, but, let's see.
Do we have any more questions?
I think we've covered all of our questions that we have down here, but wow.
Cool
I'm
stuff.
Sure there are a lot more that will pop up as we think about this and ruminate. In fact, I already remember that I had a few questions during the break that I forgot to ask, and now I've forgotten what they were. But I wish I could ask them.
We'll have to do an episode 2 sometime.
Yeah. Yeah, and would it be okay if we set up another episode sometime in the future and talk about some of the other cool stuff we've done?
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure, I'd love to.
Awesome.
Captive audience.
Yeah. But a willing captive audience.
Yeah.
Oh, there we go. It makes it even better.
Yeah.
Okay, well, thanks a lot, Dave. We appreciate
you
being on the show.
Thank you. I enjoy talking to anybody who will dare listen to my stories about worms.
Thank you for listening to this edition of the Aquarimax Audio Show. For additional episodes, please visit aquarimax.com. For comments and or questions that may be featured on an upcoming podcast, leave a message at 801-477-0629 or email us at info@aquarimax.com.